Hey everybody, KMO here. It is April 3rd, 2024. And what I have for you in this episode is the first six chapters of a novella. It's called Last Train to Mordor, and it takes place in the Kuiper Belt. It is a prelude to my debut novel, which is called Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt, Gen X Science Fiction. It is available on Amazon.com as both a Kindle, and in the fullness of time, I intend that it should be available as an audiobook, although that is time-consuming, challenging, and/or expensive to bring about. Unless, of course, I just decide to let Amazon make it using their virtual voice technology, but I'm pretty sure they're going to get a lot of pronunciations wrong. So what you're going to hear is the first six of 21 chapters in Last Train to Mordor. The entire novella is available on my Substack, and there'll be a link in the show description. But, if you just want to do a search for KMO Substack, that ought to get you to me. So the main character in the novel is a woman named Anya Petrovic. Anya is a genetically engineered soldier for the Pax Columbia, one of the major human factions in the Kuiper Belt. I was told by an advanced reader of my book that I should probably define the Kuiper Belt in the book, and I didn't ignore that advice, but I also didn't take it. I figured science fiction readers probably know what the Kuiper Belt is, but just, for the sake of completeness, the Kuiper Belt it's a region of the solar system. It is out past the orbit of Neptune. So that whole region, it could be called the Kuiper Belt. It could be called the Kuiper Belt and scattered disk. But anything out past Neptune is trans-Neptunian. So that's in trans-Neptunian space. You may recall several years ago, an astronomical nomenclature body decided that Pluto was no longer a planet. And they gave a variety of reasons for that. But one of the most obvious, when you look at Pluto's orbit compared to the orbits of the other planets, it's very elliptical, so much so that sometimes Pluto is closer to the sun than Neptune is, and sometimes it's much further from the sun than Neptune. So it crosses Neptune's orbit. It doesn't have its own lane, basically. All the other planets have their own lane. It takes Pluto 248 Earth years to go around the sun once. The place in its orbit, and this isn't unique to Pluto, but the place in its orbit where it is closest to the sun is called perihelion. In the context of the story, there is a Dyson sphere around the sun. Humans living out in the Kuiper Belt haven't seen the sun in generations. The inner system, everything inside the Dyson sphere, is controlled by an artificial superintelligence, and the people out in the Kuiper Belt, they don't know if that ASI is multiple minds or one big mind. They just don't know. But they hate it. To get an explanation as to why they hate it, read my novel, Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt. But the last time Pluto came this close to the sun, the last time it reached perihelion, the powers scoured it of all human life. Or so the lore goes. Nobody living at this time in the story was alive the last time that happened. It was almost 250 years ago. Something else to know about Pluto, which makes it, to me, utterly fascinating. Some bodies, many planets, are tidally locked, which means one face of them always faces the star that they're orbiting around. The moon, Earth's moon, is tidally locked to the Earth. Whenever you look up at the moon, you always see the same face. It rotates on its axis, but we never see the far side of the moon, what we call the dark side of the moon, because the moon always has the same face facing the Earth. Well, Pluto and its largest moon, Charon, are not exactly the same size, but pretty close. So much so that Charon doesn't orbit Pluto. Charon and Pluto both orbit a center of gravity called a barycenter, which is between the two bodies. And both bodies are tidally locked to one another. So Charon and Pluto always show each other the same face, which means, in theory, it's possible to build a bridge between the two bodies. You couldn't build a bridge from the Earth to the moon because even though the moon is tidally locked to the Earth is not tidally locked to the moon. So you couldn't have a bridge between the two bodies. With Charon and Pluto, you can. And also, Charon and Pluto are not that far apart. They're only about 19,000 kilometers apart. So in the context of this story, there is what you could call a space elevator that links Pluto to Charon. And along that cable, which is called the link, there are four ring habitats that spin to create gravity. Gravity on Pluto and Charon both are very, very light, less than 5% of what you're used to. All right, so with that introduction out of the way, here's the first six chapters of Last Train to Mordor.
One. Nix at first sight. Anya Petrovic didn't know if Clement's ship really had a transparent hull, or if the bulkheads and decks were coated with light-emitting elements that turned the whole passenger compartment into a VR suite. But the hull had seemed transparent from the moment she set foot inside his ship on Galtz. Masada, the other soldier Clement furloughed from the Galtz militia for this job, insisted that it was some kind of advanced Nixian tech creating the illusion of a transparent hull. Otherwise, we'd see Mr. Clement up in the cockpit, he reasoned. That made sense to Petrovic, but she didn't care enough to interrogate Losada's reasoning. She was into people, not tech. Now, she could see the linked spheres of the Nix system growing larger. She'd trained on Nixian military tech since childhood, and the Nixians designed her genome. But she'd never been to the Nix system before. So that's Nix, Petrovic said. No, Losada said, that's Pluto and Charon. Nix is much smaller. It orbits the other two. He held up his slate and swept it around, using it to locate the smaller moon. There, he said, and pointed. Red and white Pluto was connected to Charon, its cratered gray companion, by what looked like a fat cable. Compared to that visual extravaganza, small, irregular Nix didn't impress Petrovic. It's just a rock, she said. It's got spin habs inside it, Losada said. Huh? I think I'd rather live on one of those ring habs, Petrovic said, looking at the four ring-shaped habitats that rotated around the 19,000-kilometer-long bridge connecting Pluto to Charon. Better view. There used to be more moons, but the Nixians dismantled them to build the link, Losada said. Shit, Petrovic said. She couldn't doubt that the link and its ring habitats existed. They were right there. But the idea that humans built all that didn't fit her worldview. The Nixians did that, not the powers? That's what my history instructor said, Losada said. Britannica says the same thing. Petrovic had gotten herself into enough trouble with her sexual indiscretions. She didn't need to risk further damage to her career by accessing unsanctioned sources of information. She was surprised to hear that Losada had consulted Britannica. He seemed like such a straight arrow. They entered into polar orbit around Charon. See the dark brown patch, Losada said, pointing out a dark region near Charon's north pole? That's Mordor Immacula. The main spaceport is there. Isn't there supposed to be a train? Petrovic said. Subsurface, Losada said. People take the link from Pluto to Charon, then travel from the link station in Minas Tirith. You mean Minth? Petrovic said. Their scant mission briefing mentioned guarding the train station in Minth. Yes, Losada said. Minth is short for Minas Tirith. That's where the passengers transfer from the link to take the train to the spaceport in Mordor. There's another spaceport on the equator, but that's for cargo. Water, ammonia, nitrogen mostly. Damn, Losada. Everyone calls me Mikey, Losada said. Damn, Losada, she repeated. You should be a tour guide. Maybe you missed your calling. Any idea why the spaceports are on Charon? Losada supplied. Why the spaceports on Charon when most of the people live on Pluto? Why not just land and take off from Pluto? Pluto has an atmosphere, Losada said. Charon doesn't. Ships that can't land on Pluto can land on Charon. Plus, Charon has slightly less mass. It takes less specific impulse to reach escape velocity. Specific impulse, Petrovic said. Listen to you. 2. The Grand Atrium. The refugees bunched into clusters in the Grand Atrium of Minth Central Station. There were other atriums in the adjacent complex of hotels and shopping arcades, now closed, that radiated out from the Charon Link Terminal. Some of those other open spaces were big, but this was the biggest, the most grand. The space was designed with the assumption that people wouldn't linger in the Grand Atrium for more than a few minutes. They either approached the security stations to be identified and directed onto the boarding area, or they said goodbye to their loved ones and left the train station. It wasn't normal for people to loiter in clumps of seated and reclining bodies, practically camping. Under normal circumstances, most travelers said their goodbyes on the Pluto side of the link. The nearly 20,000-kilometer trip up the link took 3 days, assuming you spent at least one day on Charon to shop and take in the sights before heading back. That was a 7-day gesture. Easier just to say goodbye on the Pluto side. The locals said down on the Pluto side, regardless of whether they were on Pluto or Charon when they said it. The locals also used the old Earth calendar. To them, the 7-day trip up and back down the link was an entire week. Petrovic wasn't a local, and she never would be. To her, you looked up from Charon to see Pluto, so Pluto was up the link. And a week was 10 days. Soon, if the panic was justified, there wouldn't be any locals in the Pluto system. No human locals, anyway. The powers would scour all life from the system when it reached perihelion, like they did 87 kb years ago, the last time Pluto got this close to the curtain. "Corporal," Lusada said over the comm link. He was just a few meters away, but they used comms so they didn't have to shout over the din of voices. "Call me Petrovic," she said. "Our ranks don't apply on private jobs." "Sorry," Lusada said. "We've got a weird situation over here. Would you come over?" "Fine," she said, and mentally plotted her course through the crowd. She was wearing a powered combat exoskeleton. It made her a full head taller and tripled her mass. It was completely unnecessary for this job. She'd done lots of crowd control ops wearing nothing more than regular tactical armor, and those were in 1G spin halves, places where these willowy Pluters couldn't even stand up. "Plutonians," she corrected her inner monologue. Pluters was a slur. She'd corrected Manx on that point. The Plutonians posed no threat to Colombian soldiers. Raised in Pluto's feeble gravity, they could grow taller than Colombian soldiers, even though Colombians were taller than most full G spinners, thanks to their genetic enhancements. The power armor put Petrovic at eye level with even the tallest Plutonian man. She understood the psychology of it, but the armor was overkill. Even if she were naked, these stick-figure people couldn't hurt her. But to realize that, some of them might have to fuck around and find out. In the power armor, she radiated invulnerability and menace. That was the point of it. She clicked her tongue, and her suit emitted an ultrasonic pulse. All the civilians within 2 meters of her took an involuntary step back. She didn't enjoy doing that. She knew it came across as bullying, but she could cripple people without meaning to if she just pushed through the crowd in her armor. She approached the checkpoint. Lusada stood in front of the narrow entry to the passenger concourse, blocking a well-dressed family from proceeding. "What's up?" Petrovic said. Lusada said, "These people have confirmed passage and an entry visa at Makemake." "So what's the holdup?" "Their visa is for 4, Lusada said. Petrovic looked at the family. Their clothes identified them as well off. The man was probably some kind of technical professional. The adult woman with him, presumably the wife, had a tiny baby in her arms. Petrovic had little experience with babies, but she thought this one couldn't be more than a few days old. There was a boy, about 3.5 by Petrovic's reckoning, nearly as tall as his mother, and a girl. She was younger, maybe 1.4 or 1.5. The girl clung to her mother's leg. "Are you in charge?" the man asked. "I'm in charge of this checkpoint," she said. "Mr. Tholen," the man said. "Adam Tholen. I'm a nuclear engineer, and we're expected on Makemake." No doubt. If what the man said was true, and by the look of him, Petrovic assumed it was, he would have no trouble arranging immigration and passage for himself and his family. With his skills, they would be welcome on any hab or rock in the Kuiper Belt. Petrovic's suit sensors scanned the man's face and produced his documents in her heads-up display. "Mr. Tholen," Petrovic said, "your visa is for a family of 4. I count 5 of you." "Yes," Tholen said. "My wife gave birth on the link ride up from Pluto." Petrovic looked at the woman. Her face was full and round for a Pluter, for a Plutonian, but she looked haggard. "Was your wife pregnant when you applied for admittance to Makemake?" Petrovic said. "Yes," Tholen said. "We told the immigration office that we had another child on the way. They said their system didn't allow them to issue visas to the unborn. They assured us it wouldn't be a problem if my wife was pregnant when we got there." "She's not pregnant now," Petrovic said, "is she?" "The baby was early," the mother said. "I'm sure they'll admit us all on Makemake," Tholen said. "Probably," Petrovic agreed, "but we're not on Makemake. The question is whether the captain of your transport will let you board at the spaceport in Mordor. If the captain signs off, we'll let you on the train. Petrovic left the otherwise part of that statement implied. How long will it take? Mr. Tholen asked. I don't know, Petrovic said. Step out of the line. You and your family can wait here at the checkpoint. Petrovic did not want to talk to Andronat Clement, the chief executive of the small and newly formed Exodus Security LLC. Her boss. She moved away from the checkpoint and composed a text summary of the situation, attached the Tholen family's travel and immigration documents, and sent them to Clement. She thought to move a few paces away from the checkpoint to monitor the crowd, but she could tell that the next man in line was going to be a problem. That's impossible, the man shouted at Losada. Do you know how much I paid for these tickets? I'm sorry, sir, Losada said. He sounded deferential, which struck Petrovic as absurd, given that Miguel, or Mikey, as she refused to call him, wore a suit of Nixian battle armor like her own. Losada was a rhinoceros deferring to a piglet. Deferring in tone only, though. This man would not be boarding the train to Mordor. Petrovic joined Losada, forming an armored wall between the angry man and his intended path. What's the problem? She said. I bought tickets to Haumea, the man said, and this pissant has the nerve to tell me they're no good. Let me guess, Petrovic said. You booked passage on the you'll own nothing and be happy. That's right, the man said. He was short for a pleuter and fleshy. He clearly didn't do any sort of physical labor, and he didn't strike Petrovic as a skilled technician like Adam Tholen. She pegged him for a small business owner. He probably owned, but didn't actively manage, a resource extraction operation, or two. An attractive young woman stood beside and slightly behind him. She had normal proportions to Petrovic's eyes, which is to say she looked like someone from a full-gravity environment. Petrovic guessed the man was over 25, though his flab might have made him look older than he was. The woman couldn't have been more than 9. Well, it's like this, Mr. His identity and fraudulent travel documents appeared in Petrovic's HUD. Putin. Frudim, he shouted. The Be Happy departed the day before yesterday. The departure date is right there on your ticket. It was delayed, he said. Rescheduled. It's leaving today. Look. He tried to forward an interchain link to her. She rejected it. The ship is gone, she told him, and glanced over at Manx, the third member of her team and the only one not wearing a powered exoskeleton. Manx wore standard riot gear, though he had discarded the helmet. He also wore a Nixian control collar. Manx was talking to a young woman, doubtless lying to her, telling her he could arrange passage for her if she made it worth his while. He turned and made eye contact with Petrovic and half-smiled. She nodded, and his half-smile grew into a malevolent grin. Petrovic turned back to Mr. Fudim. I suggest you leave before my associate gets here, she told him, not really caring whether he followed her advice. She remembered someone telling her that the key to giving advice was to not give a shit if the other person took it or not. Once you gave it, your part was over. Losada turned his head and stepped away as Manx approached the checkpoint. Petrovic knew Miguel Mikey Losada had never worked crowd control before. Losada empathized with these people and did not want to see what came next. Manx reached out a casual hand and took hold of the pinky finger on Fudum's left hand. Fudum looked from his captured digit to Manx's face. Manx held the fleshy man's gaze while he broke the finger. Fudum howled. Manx punched Fudum in the solar plexus, and the man doubled over. Manx took him by the throat and stood him upright again. He struck Fudum in the ear with an open palm. Petrovic knew how much ear cartilage trauma hurt, but the punch to the solar plexus had emptied Fudum's lungs. He didn't have the breath to give adequate voice to this fresh pain. Manx was powerful, a bastard son of the Colombian military establishment. Either a parent or grandparent had been a purebred Colombian soldier. Manx inherited the strength, size, and reflexes of a Colombian. What he lacked was the training and the discipline. After Clement paid to furlough Petrovic and Losada from the garrison on Galtz, he took his new employees to the original Colombia spinhab. Officially, Colombia counted as abandoned and had been since the blackout. But people still lived there. Now it held thousands instead of millions, but it still had an atmosphere and rotational gravity. Of course, some people would make a go of it there. Hardy people. People like Manx. Clement, Petrovic and Losada went hunting in the darkness of the abandoned habitat, formerly the seat of wealth, culture, and power in this quarter of the Kuiper Belt. They took a score of Nixian control collars with them, and with all 20 collars locked around squatters' necks, they picked the biggest, meanest-looking one and made him an offer. He could face justice for the crime of looting, or he could go to work for Exodus Security. Scavengers had been running illegal salvage operations in the abandoned habitat for decades. They weren't looting in the traditional sense so much as slowly strip-mining the place. But Colombian military tribunals still charged scavengers with looting. Looting was a capital crime. Faced with the choice of death or working security for Clement, Manx took the security job. He did not know at the time how much he would enjoy the work. Manx continued to work Foodum over, pausing once to appraise his victim's female companion and then returning to inflicting intense pain without knocking Foodum unconscious or spilling blood. Eventually, Foodum went limp, and Manx dragged him through the crowd out toward the middle of the grand atrium, where he deposited the flaccid body and turned his attention to Foodum's companion, who had followed Manx out into the grand atrium. Petrovic didn't like working with Manx. He was a sadist, maybe even a psychopath. She realized, not for the first time, that she really shouldn't be fucking him. 3. The solution. Another link capsule from Pluto disgorged its human cargo at the terminal. The passengers, after enduring the punishing deceleration, staggered out of the tunnel from the link terminal into the grand atrium of the train station. Far more people arrived on the link than would be allowed onto the trains. Those trying to escape Pluto before perihelion had to pass through 3 gauntlets. The first was on Pluto. To get on the link, they had to present proof that they had booked and paid for passage from the spaceport on Charon. They also had to prove that they would be allowed to disembark at the ship's destination. That meant a work contract, an immigration permit, or possibly a student or cultural visa. The captain of the ship needed to know that he or she would not be taking on a passenger they couldn't get rid of. The security teams at the link terminal on Pluto were supposed to turn away anyone who could not produce these documents. But it was clear to Petrovic that most of the people accumulating in the grand atrium never should have been allowed onto the link. Employees of Exodus Security LLC screened the passengers on Pluto, here in Minth, and at the Mordor spaceport. Petrovic suspected that Clement told his employees on Pluto to solicit bribes and let unqualified passengers onto the link. He probably set a quota. Petrovic and the other security teams here on Charon were supposed to hold the line, take no bribes, and only let qualified passengers board the train. What were the crowds of people accumulating in the grand atrium supposed to do? Where did Clement expect them to go? Not everyone stuck between the first and second gauntlet had bribed their way onto the link. Many paid for what they thought were legitimate tickets. One popular scam involved selling passage on ships that had already departed and would not be returning. The scammer explained that complications caused flight delays that had not yet been reflected in the official departure schedule. They provided a link to a provisional departure schedule that looked nothing like the official schedule. People desperate to believe the lie overlooked obvious signs of fraud. Mr. Foodum, the belligerent would-be passenger whom Manx had escorted away from the security checkpoint, tried to direct Petrovic to a fake timetable. She rejected the link because she'd already seen it. Mr. Putin wasn't the first person to fall for that scam. Where the adults staggered and dragged their exhausted bodies into the grand atrium from the link terminal, the children bounded ahead, delighted to be back in a low-gravity environment. Charon's gravity was 5.4% of what Petrovic was used to, having been born and raised on Galtz, a 1G spinhab. To her, this sliver of gravity was more annoying than full weightlessness. She'd had extensive microgravity combat training. Charon's paltry gravity was just enough to invoke her 1G reflexes, but nothing behaved the way she expected it to. It amused Petrovic to overhear Plutonians commenting on Charon's low gravity. Charon's gravity was 0.0054G. Pluto has 0.0063G. Petrovic couldn't imagine feeling such a slight difference. Her Nixian exoskeleton annoyed her when she had to pick her way through a crowd of fragile human bodies, but when she had open ground to cover, it was a blessing. It tripled her mass, and countless tiny actuators in the suit adjusted themselves to adapt to her stride. When she had room to walk at a comfortable pace, the suit made her feel like she was striding across the Presidio parade ground back on Galtz. The sophistication of the Nixian armor put the Columbian stuff she'd used in the past to shame. She understood that even the standard power armor that the Columbian military used came from Nix. They must sell their low-grade stuff to the Columbians and hold their high-end gear in reserve for people like Clement. "Speak of the devil," Petrovic muttered to herself when she caught sight of her employer making his way through the crowd. He wore a long gray coat with a military cut but no insignia. He went bareheaded, something no Colombian officer who wore a coat like that would do, and the coat was slate gray rather than the familiar Colombian green or black. Andronat Clement was definitely not of Colombian stock. He was shorter than Petrovic and lightly built, bordering on gaunt. She couldn't pin down his age. His white hair had receded into a pronounced widow's peak, exposing lots of shiny scalp on either side. His neatly trimmed mustache and goatee were also white. He had deep lines around the corners of his eyes, and in his perpetually scowling brow, as well as deep vertical creases in his cheeks. But his skin had the elasticity of youth. If she had to guess, she would say he was 17. As he got closer, Petrovic could see that he was wearing his own Nixian armor under the long coat. Where Petrovic's armor was deliberately bulky, his was so form-fitting that he could conceal it under loose clothing and still strike a slender profile. He'd worn that armor on their hunt through the darkened remains of Columbia Hab, when they captured Manx and the other squatters Clement pressed into service. She couldn't be certain how much of his speed, agility, and strength came from his body and how much from his Nixian tech, but she didn't take her physical advantage over him for granted. "Where's the family?" Clement said when he reached Petrovic. "This way." Petrovic led the way, but when Clement saw the Tholen family seated on their luggage, he overtook her and made directly for them. The crowd parted for him. Clement showed no reservations about using ultrasound pulses to clear a path through the throng. Petrovic followed in his wake. "Mr. Zorlen, my name is Clement. I'm a private security contractor," Clement said, not offering to shake Adam Tholen's hand. "Did you talk to the ship's captain?" Tholen said. "Did you explain?" "The captain will only take four of you. To do otherwise would void his insurance policy," Clement said. Petrovic doubted Clement even contacted the ship's captain. "If it's a matter of money," Tholen said, "most of our funds are tied up, but with a little time..." "Money will not solve your problem," Clement said, cutting Tholen off again. "I have a contact who works for a relief agency who might be able to get one of your children on a ship bound for Olympus." Mrs. Tholen listened quietly until Clement mentioned splitting up her children. She erupted into protective motion, gathering the boy and girl to her. She held the newborn in her left arm and wrapped her right arm around her son's shoulders, with the girl nestled between them. "You can't take my children. I won't let you," she said. "Correct," Clement said, making no effort to affect a reassuring tone. "I cannot be responsible for a child's welfare. I have a contact in a relief agency. She has one open seat. But the ship departs for Mordor shortly. If you refuse this opportunity, I wash my hands of this matter." "Mr. Clement," Adam Tholen said, "there must be some other way. Olympus habitat is for Martians. The gravity..." "The gravity would be unworkable for you or your wife," Clement said, "but a young child could adapt." Clement looked at the children. His gaze swept over the boy without pausing and landed on the daughter, who shrank back. "The girl stands the best chance. The boy's skeletal development is too advanced." Horrified, Mrs. Tholen turned to her husband. "Adam, we can't." Mr. Tholen joined his family in their protective huddle. Clement raised his hand and signaled to someone in the crowd. A portly woman, clearly not from Pluto, approached them. Her facial expression radiated maternal care and compassion. "This is Miss Doré," Clement said. "Direct your concerns to her. I have other matters to attend to." Without saying goodbye or excusing himself, Clement disappeared into the crowd. The plump woman approached the family, her eyes wide with exaggerated compassion. "Mr. and Mrs. Zorlen, my name is Yvonne. I work for Protéger les Enfants Martiens. We have come from Olympus to catch the young children who have, as they say, fallen through the cracks in this crisis," Doré told them. "Andronach told me of your predicament. I believe I can help, but we must move quickly." "This can't be the only way," Mrs. Tholen said, tears streaming down her face. "I know. It is heartbreaking," Miss Doré said, stroking Mrs. Tholen's cheek, all beneficence and reassurance. "Believe me, your precious darling would be well cared for. We will strive to place her in a loving family on Olympus, and in the fullness of time, she may join you on Makemake." "Miss Doré," Mr. Tholen said. Call me Ivan, please, Doré said. I understand this is all very sudden, but we must move quickly. If you endorse this document placing your daughter in my care, we can all board this train together. I will answer all your questions on the passage to the spaceport. If you are not satisfied with my answers, you may all return here to Minsk together. But I must board this next train to Mordor. Won't you come with me? Won't you let me help your precious little girl? Petrovic could not see the blockchain agreements they passed back and forth. It all took place on the interchain, but when the process was complete, Petrovic let four Tholens pass the checkpoint and one aid worker, with a now orphaned girl in her custody. They all disappeared down the tube to the boarding area together. Petrovic swallowed and opened a voice connection with Clément. They're never going to see that girl again, are they? Unknown, Clément said. She'll end up in a brothel, or worse. Not your concern. I assume you will reject your finder's fee as a matter of conscience. She cut the voice connection before she told Clément how much she wanted him dead. Four. Sugar. At the halfway point of their shift, Petrovic told Lasada to take a break, get something to eat, and be back in half a watch. That was a long break, but the traffic through their checkpoint had slowed to an intermittent trickle. At the start of their shift, passengers with tickets and legitimate documents formed a long line at the security checkpoint. Now the Grand Atrium was more crowded than ever, but few people approached the checkpoint. Those who did came to plead, wheedle, or bluff their way past the checkpoint and onto the train. Petrovic turned them away at the first failure to produce a document, but Lasada listened to everyone's story. Petrovic knew when to clamp down on her empathic impulses, but Lasada didn't have that skill. He lacked the necessary psychological and emotional barriers for this work. Every hard luck story drew him in. Petrovic sent him on an extra long break and told him to find a restricted area in which to rest. She was explicit that he was not to remove his armor or talk to the locals. Manx, on the other hand, had won the lottery. Word of his brutal assaults had spread through the crowd of refugees, and their fear of him stoked his self-importance. He used his presence and implied promises of passage to assemble a harem. He kept a trio of attractive young women in an area just off to the side of the security checkpoint. He dismissed the least attractive of them every time he found one he liked better. Manx did this right in front of Petrovic, despite their sexual relationship. Petrovic had no interest in a monogamous arrangement with Manx, but his complete lack of conscientious pretense impressed her. While Petrovic did what she could to insulate Lasada from the desperate Plutonians, she encouraged Manx to circulate and gather intel. He ran a gang on Columbia Hab, and he was quick to recruit older boys to act as his informants here on Charon. Conversations went quiet when Manx passed nearby, but his young spies took the temperature of the growing crowd, eavesdropped on adult conversations, and returned to the security checkpoint to report to Manx. Manx did not bother to learn the names of his concubines or his soldiers. He assigned tough-sounding nicknames to the boys and salacious ones to the women. For the boys, the monosyllabic nicknames he gave them, Pike, Griff, Tar, Rack, served as their own reward, or so Petrovic imagined. The women probably put up with his diminutives in the hopes of getting something down the line. One of the older boys, the one Manx called Pike, approached his leader with some new report. Petrovic knew that Manx would not relay the information to her until she asked for an update. Manx kept his harem and his young recruits just far enough from the checkpoint that Petrovic could not overhear them without leaving her post, something she couldn't do with Lasada on break. When Pike slipped back into the crowd, Petrovic called Manx over. "What's the latest?" she asked when he reached her. "That fat Martian bitch showed up again, just like he said she would," Manx said. Yvonne Doré, when she convinced the Tholen family to transfer custody of their daughter to her, claimed that she was leaving Charon on the next transport. But she appeared back in the Grand Atrium within a watch, convincing other distraught parents to entrust their children to her. Doré had an arrangement with Clément, so Petrovic could not act openly to disrupt her operation. She told Manx to use his young recruits to spread the word to parents, but the woman was a front for a child trafficking operation. "What else?" Petrovic said. "Some wise guys have set up a toll booth," Manx said. "They'd charge you to use the toilets. The polluters that can't pay are pissing in cups and bottles and dumping them in the planters and fountains and whatnot." "Wise guys?" Petrovic said. "Organized?" "Could be," Manx said. "Want me to check it out?" "Yes," Petrovic said. "Put an end to it, and make a show of it. I don't want to smell piss and shit all day." "On it, boss," he said, and set off into the crowd. He didn't have the means to part the crowd with ultrasonic pulses like Petrovic could, but his bearing and reputation had the same effect. Petrovic knew she was walking a fine line. If the toll booth operation was organized, Clément probably had something to do with it. Either he arranged it, or he took a cut in exchange for tolerating it. Before Petrovic left Galtz with Clément, a woman in a black uniform paid her a visit. The woman didn't identify herself, but Petrovic recognized a Colombian intelligence officer when she saw one. The woman impressed upon Petrovic the need to provide top-flight service to Clément on this job. It was obvious to Petrovic from Clément's gear that he worked with, if not directly for, the Nixian technologists. The woman from the intelligence service confirmed this. She reminded Petrovic that the Colombian military needed to maintain excellent relations with the Nixians. Clément engaged in the sorts of extralegal activities that the Colombian military normally tasked itself with disrupting. In this instance, Petrovic was not to interfere with Clément's business. Higher-ups had instructed her to turn a blind eye to criminal activity in the past. It was out of the ordinary, but there was precedent. What the intelligence officer said next changed Petrovic's view of the universe and her place in it. For the duration of this assignment, the Colombian military code of conduct with regard to the treatment of civilians is suspended. Petrovic had killed civilians in riot suppression operations. She had crippled civilians who approached her clients on bodyguard assignments. In no instance had she been reprimanded or even called upon to account for her actions. The Colombian military was not fussy about the uniform code of conduct when it came to civilian collateral damage. The intelligence officer told her that even the normal civilian protections, which rarely amounted to more than an empty gesture, did not apply when she was assigned to Clément's service. For the sake of her career, the smart move was to set her conscience aside and give Clément her active cooperation. She couldn't bring herself to do that, but if she couldn't change his course, she could at least create some drag and slow his progress. She wouldn't go against explicit instructions, but as long as she could maintain plausible deniability, she would resist where she could. Petrovic's stomach growled. She hadn't eaten since their early breakfast. She normally ate 5 meals a day, and she could feel her muscle mass evaporating by the minute. Her genetic enhancements delayed the muscle and bone atrophy that came from extended periods in low gravity, and then slowed the deterioration once it set in. But she wasn't eating and working out like she did in the garrison back on Galtz. She knew she could regain the lost weight when the job was over, but she hated to give up her hard-won gains, even temporarily. She looked over at the three women in Manx's harem. Two of the women were as tall as Petrovic and Manx, but the third had more standard proportions. She looked like she could be from Galtz, or Twain, or some other 1G spinhab. Petrovic focused her attention on the shorter woman and called her over with a gesture when she looked up. "What's your name?" Petrovic asked the woman when she reached the checkpoint. "I guess it's Sugar Tits now," she said, without any hint of joking. Petrovic rolled her eyes and shook her head. "Yeah," Petrovic said, "he's a real piece of work. But good in bed, if you like it rough. What's your real name?" "Why don't you call me Sugar? If he hears it often enough, he might call me that too." "You sure?" Petrovic said. "My real name is Astoria," she said, "but I don't want him to know that." Petrovic imagined the creativity Manx would apply to any woman's name starting with ass and laughed. "Yeah," Petrovic said, "that wouldn't go well. I'm Petrovic, but call me Anya when he's around." "Only when he's around?" Sugar asked. "Whatever," Petrovic said. "I'm not picky. We go by our family names in the service. I'm used to being called Petrovic, but Anya's fine." "Were you the one traveling with that Putin guy?" Now Sugar laughed. "His name is Fudim, but Putin fits him better. And yes, he said he could get me out of the Pluto system before, you know." "Where is he now?" Petrovic said. "Dead to me," Sugar said. "Did you work for him?" "Not exactly. I'm a part owner of a bar. At least I was. Fudin was a regular client. He entertained his business contacts there. He was in my bar most nights, paid monthly," Sugar said. "I wasn't his mistress. I've got my own money, but money won't get you on a ship right now. Fudin said he had connections, and like an idiot, I believed him." "You were fucking him?" Petrovic said. "Only twice," Sugar said, "thank the stars." "And now you're with Manx," Petrovic said. "Did he promise to get you out?" "No," Sugar said. "I'm mostly just with him for protection. This crowd is getting crazy. They're desperate." "He said he's got a luxury hotel suite. Is that true?" "It's not his, but yes," Petrovic said. "Our employer has a whole floor at the Honor. Me, Manx, and Lasada all have private rooms off a luxury suite. It's posh. Did Manx say you could spend the night there?" He implied it, Sugar said. If I'm still in his little club by the end of the day. Look at those other two, they're like models. I'll be the one he kicks out if something better comes along. Nah, Petrovic said, you're good. Show me your palm. Sugar held up her hand, and Petrovic's helmet sensors scanned her palm and retinas. I've got your biometrics in the system under Sugar Petrovic. That'll get you into the lobby, elevator, and our suite. Petrovic, huh? Sugar said. Does that make me your wife? Or sister, Petrovic said. I know I don't look it, but I'm mostly into men. Anyway, you're set. For tonight, anyway. Thank you, Anya. Manx returned with his young henchman. He had a flat box in one arm, and his mouth was stuffed with some kind of food. As he came closer to the checkpoint, Petrovic could see that the shallow box was half full of individually wrapped snacks. What's that? Petrovic said, pointing at the box. Manx looked at the snacks and pointed to his shortest protege, Tar. Manx made muffled mouth noises, his maw too full of food to form intelligible speech sounds. Cheesecake cups, Tar said. He had crumbs at the corners of his mouth and on his shirt. All of Manx's minions showed similar evidence of having gotten a share of the bounty. Manx was a tyrant and a bully, but he had the good sense to buy loyalty when it was cheap. He held the box out to Petrovic. The cheesecake cups looked inviting, but she knew better than to eat food of unknown providence while on duty. She shook her head. Manx held out the box to Sugar, who didn't hesitate. He looked from Sugar to Petrovic. She yours now? We can share, Petrovic said, not wanting Manx to think he had an open harem slot he could fill. What's the situation with the public toilets? Amateurs, I think, Manx said, passing the box of treats to Tar and gesturing toward the two Plutonian beauties who were drifting toward the checkpoint. Pluters, Manx continued. They tried to blend into the crowd when they saw me coming, but the crowd wasn't having it. Pushed him right to me and I gave him something to think about. Dead? Petrovic asked. Probably not. Pretty sure they were still breathing, most of them. And the cakes? Petrovic said. Show of appreciation from the community. They cheered like anything. I'm on my way to being a local hero, ain't that right, Griff? That's right, Chief, his flunky said. Everybody loves you, or they're afraid of you. Believe that, Manx said, meaning. Petrovic saw Losada making his slow and careful way through the crowd, coming back from his break early and not using ultrasonic pulses to clear a path across the field of delicate Plutonian bodies. Petrovic scowled and wondered if Command had picked soft-hearted Mikey Losada for this moral cesspit of an assignment. If so, why? To shock him out of his moral delusions or just for the sheer perverse cruelty of it? I'm going on break, Petrovic said to Manx. Losada is in charge until I get back. Sugar, you're with me. There you go, boss. Now you're getting rid of this thing of things, Manx said, leering at Sugar. Enjoy the perky sets of the situation. It's perquisites, you animal, Petrovic said. Even a dumb grunt like me knows that. All I know is that they're pretty perky, Manx said. He pantomimed pinching his nipples through his armor. Show the boss a good time, Sugar Tits. Petrovic led Sugar to an off-limits area. As they approached, a security gate opened, and an obsequious computer voice said, Welcome, Anya. Welcome, Sugar. The gate closed behind them, and they moved into a seating area, where upside-down chairs were stacked on round tabletops. The sound of voices from the grand atrium was a distant burble. Pick a table, Petrovic said. I'm going to do something I told Losada not to do, don't tell. She undid various clasps on her exoskeleton, and within a minute she stepped out of it, wearing a skin-tight black bodysuit and a gun belt with a holstered pistol. Wait here, Petrovic said, and walked behind a serving counter to retrieve two boxed meals. Petrovic stretched for a moment before sitting down at the table and opening her meal box. Oh, stars, Sugar said. Is this pheasant? Is it? Petrovic said. I don't know. This fancy stuff is wasted on me. I usually focus on nutrients over taste. But this is what we've got. This is amazing. You always eat like this? Sugar said. Not normally, Petrovic said. Not like this, but our boss on this job has expensive tastes. Do you drink? Yes, Sugar said. I don't. Not anymore, Petrovic said. Our suite has a full bar, and the bottles all look expensive. You owned a bar. You'll know better than me if it's high-end stuff. May I ask why you stopped drinking? Impulse control, Petrovic said. I have a problem with sex. I can't go without it, and alcohol makes everything worse. I make bad decisions around sex when I'm sober. Get me drunk, forget about it. I take it you're sleeping with Manx, Sugar said. I'm fucking him, Petrovic said. I sleep alone. You can come get my bed if Manx gets too rough, or if you just won't pass out and you want to get some sleep. He's not allowed in my room. The conversation trailed off, and both women focused on their food. Petrovic finished her pheasant and root vegetables, but left her risotto untouched. She fetched a third box and demolished the pheasant from that one as well. When Sugar finished eating, she resumed her questions. "Do you like Manx?" "Fuck no," Petrovic said. "He's a psychopath. I should be fucking Mikey, but the cunt wants what the cunt wants, if you know what I mean. I'm gonna break it off with Manx. Soon. But not now. The situation is too stressful. Stress makes me horny." "I think you and I have lived very different lives," Sugar said. "Truth," Anya said. "Are you from here? You don't look like a Pluter. Sorry, like a Plutonian. I've lived in the Pluto system all my life, but when I was little, my family lived on one of the ring habitats on the Link, the 0.7G ring. That's why I'm short." "A lazy G-hab? Nice," Anya said. "That means you've got more options than most Plutonians. You can go to any Mars-equivalent hab. You could probably even do a full 1G. It would be a rough transition, but I bet you could tough it out." "I just need to get on a ship," Sugar said. 5. The squeeze. Petrovic opened a comm channel to Lasada. "Lasada, what's the situation at the checkpoint?" "Quiet, I guess," Mikey said.
"You guess?"
"The people seem really tense, more so than when you left."
"What?"
"Okay. Manx says the vending stations have shut down. People can't get anything to eat." "I'll check it out," Petrovic said, and closed the channel. "Come on, Sugar. Little detour." Petrovic changed direction and made for the perimeter of the great open space of the Grand Atrium. Clusters of tables announced the locations of banks of food dispensers set into the wall. The sound of an impact cut through the sonic fuzz of overlapping voices. She heard it, but she couldn't identify it. A third impact allowed her to pinpoint the general direction of the source, and she headed that way, sending ultrasound pulses ahead of her to clear a path. Petrovic chuckled when she identified the source of the sound. A Plutonian man, tall and wispy like the rest of them, but maybe a little broader than normal across the shoulders, swung a chair into the clear face of a vending station. Instead of four legs, the chair had two loops of metal flattened at the bottom to provide a base of support. When the leading loop hit the clear face of the vending station, the momentum of the chair transferred up the man's arms and into his body. He lost his balance and fell, but he fell with athletic grace and wasn't hurt. Petrovic cut off the crowd-dispersing pulses as she got close to the man, but he shuddered, as if he'd caught at least some measure of the last pulse. The man used the chair to push himself back up to a standing position. He looked at Petrovic in her imposing armor and released his hold on the chair. "Don't let me stop you," Petrovic said. "It looks like you've just about got it. One more swing ought to do it." The man looked over at the transparent panel that separated him from the displayed dishes. After all that effort, the vending station showed no sign of damage. "What are we supposed to do? The prices have been going up all day, and now it doesn't list any prices," the man said. "It's got power, and if the food was all gone, it would say out of stock, but it doesn't say anything." "So you are going to break the transparency and eat the display model," Petrovic said. "You think that's edible?" "What do you mean?"
"The display items are made of cast resin," Sugar said. "You can't eat them."
"What are we supposed to do?" the man repeated. "I honestly don't know," Petrovic told him. "Are you traveling alone?" The man looked over his shoulder at an attractive young woman dressed in an expensive-looking tracksuit and an older woman who wore more formal clothing. Petrovic turned and took one of the boxed meals from Sugar. She handed it to the athletic-looking man. "Here, you'll have to share it," she said. The man looked at the box. "One meal for three people?" "Or you could be a man," Petrovic said, "and let your women split it. That's what a Colombian man would do." The man looked indignant. He drew a breath as if to respond, but then thought better of it. He turned and walked toward the two women. "Give that other box to someone with kids," Petrovic told Sugar. "The beauty queens will have to wait till supper. Trust me, you don't want to be carrying food through this crowd." They made their way back to the checkpoint. Petrovic noticed that the great ornamental fountains had been turned off. She saw people filling water bottles from the basins of the still fountains and remembered Manx telling her that people had been pissing in bottles and dumping them into the fountains earlier in the day, when thugs were barring access to the public toilets. "Shit," Petrovic said. There were water dispensing stations where people could refill bottles for a small fee or even catch a mouthful for free. She looked around and located the nearest water station. A cluster of agitated people jostled around it. She imagined that she could see waves of anxiety radiating out from the water station as the news spread that there was nothing to drink. "What the hell?" Petrovic said. Back at the checkpoint, Losada gave her a pleading look. He was on the verge of panic and needed direction. "Where's Manx?" Petrovic said. "He took those other women to the link," Losada said. "Mr. Clement came by. He said they're going to send out a public announcement in a few minutes. To get food or water, people will have to board the link back up to Pluto. Down to Pluto. There's going to be a crush of people rushing to the link terminal," Petrovic said. "People are going to get hurt." "That's what Manx said. He went to make sure the women and the boys got there ahead of time," Losada said.
"He did?" Petrovic said.
She adjusted her opinion of Manx. He was a savage, but even savages looked after their own. Petrovic heard a commotion and spotted a tight group of people driving their way through the crowd. The two in the lead wore exoskeletons like hers. They were clearing a path through the crowd, and by the way the people shrieked and spasmed as they struggled to get out of the way, Petrovic understood that the new arrivals had their ultrasound crowd dispersal gear turned up to the highest setting. Behind the two armored figures came Clement. He told Petrovic over voice comms to clear the checkpoint. His group would be passing through without showing documentation. She confirmed and warned the few people near the checkpoint to move back or get hurt. The people scattered. When Clement's group reached the checkpoint, the two armored figures, one male and one female, peeled off and stood by Petrovic and Losada, forming an armored corridor for the group of people to pass through on their way to the tube that led to the boarding area. Clement passed by and disappeared down the tunnel at the head of the group. Petrovic noticed that none of the people Clement escorted to the train platform were Plutonians. They looked like the sort of civilians Petrovic was used to seeing on Galtz, not Colombian, but adapted to life in one gravity. On impulse, Petrovic moved out of position, took Sugar by the arm, and pushed her into the back of Clement's group. Sugar locked eyes with Petrovic, stunned by the sudden development. "Anya, I..." "Shut up and go," Petrovic said, and watched Sugar disappear down the tube. There were two more armored figures at the back of the group who turned around when they reached the tunnel entrance. Petrovic approached one of them. He was stocky with broad facial features, definitely not Colombian. She'd fought Khanate forces in the disputed regions at the edge of Pax space. She recognized this man as a Mongol. The Khanate bred a robust soldier caste, just like the Colombians did. The man wore Nixian armor like Petrovic's, including the Exodus Security corporate logo. "Speak Pax?" Petrovic asked the man.
"Little,"
he said, in a deep, thickly accented voice.
"What's happening?" she said.
"From now, Pluters know." The man made a fist and thumped his chest plate. "Only strong go."
"Tell me in your language," Petrovic said.
She was only fluent in Pax, though she spoke a bit of Martian French. She could not understand a word of what the Mongol mercenary told her. She recorded his words, intending to translate them back at the hotel. The mercenary understood what she intended, and he spoke at length until Petrovic looked over the man's shoulder to let him know that Clement was coming back. The Mongol mercenary stopped talking in mid-sentence.
"Shit," she said.
Clement had Sugar with him.
6.
Benefits. Clement approached Petrovic and released his grip on Sugar's upper arm.
"You can each take one civilian," Clement said. "They will leave with us, not before. They must be able to adapt to a full Earth gravity environment. Consider your bonus. If you interfere with my business, your bonus is forfeit. You can each take one civilian," Clement said. "They will leave with us, not before. They must be able to adapt to a full Earth gravity environment. Consider your bonus. If you interfere with my business, your bonus is forfeit." Petrovic gritted her teeth.
"Where is Manx?" Clement said. Looking over Clement's shoulder, Petrovic saw a black-haired boy bobbing up and down above the heads of the crowd. Clement turned to follow her gaze. She recognized the boy as one of Manx's little recruits, the youngest, Tar. Most likely named for his black hair, his skin was Plutonian pale. The crowd parted to reveal Manx walking toward the checkpoint, carrying Tar on his shoulders. Clement spoke to one of the Mongol mercenaries in a language that Petrovic didn't understand. The mercenary, a woman, handed Clement a small black pouch, which Clement passed to Petrovic.
"The child will need therapy to adapt to food gravity," Clement said. "One injection daily before bed."
Again, Clement spoke to his Mongol mercenaries in what Petrovic assumed was their native language. They formed up around him, and the five of them set off through the crowd without explanation.
"What I miss?" Manx said.
"Our employer just explained the benefits package," Petrovic told him. "We can each pick one civilian to go with us when we leave,
I've got sugar. If you want to take tar, he'll need injections. Petrovic pushed the black pouch into Manx's chest. As soon as he put a hand up to support it, she turned away. She wanted to hit something, but there was nothing within easy reach except human bodies. If she punched someone while wearing her exoskeleton, it would kill them. She clenched her fists, her jaw, her brows, squeezing her eyes shut tight. She willed her need for violence to stay inside her. She crushed it down into a dense black sphere, her own little black hole eating away at her from the inside. And no one died. Corporal? It was Losada. She opened her eyes. When she saw the expression on his face, she wished she hadn't. He was lost, bewildered. She checked the impulse to remind him that her rank didn't apply here. He needed the familiarity of the rank structure. He needed a superior to tell him what to do. "What is it, Losada?" she said. "I don't understand," he said. "They're paying us in people?" "Not exactly," she said. "Did you get a briefing from military intelligence before we left Galtz?" "No," Mikey said. "Clement is a criminal," she said. "And until this job is done, we're criminals too. Command knows about it. They signed off on it." "I don't understand," Mikey said. "That's because you're a decent person," she said. "I know you've seen combat, but you've never quelled a food riot. You've never put down a strike or helped squash an insurrection." "I'm a soldier," Mikey said. "That doesn't mean what you think it means," Petrovic said. "Look, it's like this. If you see someone here who's trying to get out, you can help them. One person. But Clement is going to use whatever you feel for that person against you. If you do something he doesn't like, you lose your bonus. The person you tried to help will die here with everyone else." "Command knows about this?" "Not the specifics," she said, "but they know what Clement is, and they don't care." "What am I supposed to do?" he said. "Just get through this." "That's all I can tell you," Petrovic said. "You can go back to being a good man when this is all over." She didn't believe that last part, but an encouraging lie didn't even make the first page of her list of transgressions. "Losada," she said. "Things are about to get much worse around here. Why don't you take sugar and tar to our suite and then come back here?" "Are you sure?" Mikey said. Petrovic looked out and saw the crowd starting to flow toward the link terminal. She knew that the ones who didn't make it onto the link would come back more desperate than ever to get past the security checkpoint and onto a train to Mordor spaceport. Some of those people would not take a verbal no for an answer. "Actually," she said, "don't come back. Just have a nice meal ready for us when we get there. Go on. Get going." By the time Petrovic and Manx made it back to the Honor Hotel, even Manx was tired of hurting unarmed, frightened people. Petrovic looked at the reflections in the polished metal of the elevator doors. She thought they should try to wipe some of the blood off their faces before they got back to the hotel suite. She would hurt herself if she tried to wipe her face while wearing the exoskeleton. Manx, who wasn't wearing an exoskeleton, could wipe his own face, but the blood didn't seem to bother him the way it bothered Petrovic. Clement had reserved an entire floor of the hotel for his use, and Petrovic saw 5 empty exoskeletons squatting on the landing outside the elevator. She gestured for Manx to go on without her, and set about getting out of her armor. It took her twice as long to undo all the straps and locking mechanisms as it had earlier in the day when she'd taken her meal break with Sugar. She stepped out of the armor, leaving 2/3 of her mass behind. She glided down the carpeted hallway to the door to their suite. She wondered which suite the Mongols were in, but she couldn't spare any mental energy to try to puzzle out the answer. She opened the door to her suite and stepped into luxury. The space was vast. It had a full bar, a long dining table, a kitchen, a seating area with chairs and couches, and an enormous tub set into a raised platform by the panoramic window. The table was set. One plate was dirty. The window looked down on the grand atrium, and Petrovic realized that Mikey, Sugar, and Tar had had a balcony seat from which to view the carnage of the last 200 minutes. Sugar stood behind the bar. She stared at Petrovic with what looked like a combination of shock and concern. Manx was on the other side of the bar, drinking from a bottle of some clear liquor. Tar slept on one of the couches, and Losada stood in the doorway to his private room. He was fully dressed in combat fatigues. He even had his boots on. Relax, Miguel, she said. We're in for the evening, but thanks for being ready to help out. Petrova crossed the shared portion of the suite toward her private room. As she walked, she unzipped the front of her bodysuit and peeled the top portion off so that she was naked from the waist up. She paused at the bar. Manx, she said, hit the shower. Take the bottle with you, but I don't want you in the hot tub until you're clean. Manx glanced at her, but said nothing. He started to raise the bottle to his lips again. She grabbed him by the Nixian control collar around his neck and said, I'm fucking serious, asshole. Shower. Now. She moved into her own private room, not bothering to close the double doors behind her. She took off her gun belt, threw it on the bed, peeled out of the bodysuit, and left it on the floor. Her private bathroom had a walk-in shower. She stepped inside, and the flow of hot water from multiple directions started automatically. She wiped her face and short-cropped hair, leaned against the wall, and sank down. The shower heads followed her movement. She didn't know how long she sat there, knees bent, back against the shower wall with the water flowing over her. Eventually, she stood up, pumped liquid soap from a wall-mounted dispenser, and scrubbed her pits and crevices. When she'd dried off, she dug into the pack on her bed and pulled out her personal slate. She crossed back across the expanse of the shared area, naked, with a bath towel draped around her neck. Anya? Sugar said when it became clear that Petrovic intended to go out into the hotel hallway naked. Petrovic ignored her, though she did notice with satisfaction that Manx had wet hair and was dressed in silk pajama bottoms. He hadn't spent as long in the shower as Petrovic had, but he was clean. Manx laughed. Get used to that, sugar tits. Petrovic ain't no kind of shy. Once again, she glided down the luxurious carpeted hallway in long, floating strides. On the landing, she touched her personal slate to the contact patch on the helmet of her exoskeleton. She transferred the recording of the Mongol mercenary's explanation about the change in mission parameters to her slate and then deleted it from her exoskeleton's buffer. She uploaded it to the interchain for translation. It read, I am Batu 12 of Quintain Okura, Wandering Comrades. The low-gravity rocks and habitats have taken as many refugees as they want. Our focus now is on getting all of the high-gravity people out and containing the Willow Ghost people. Mars-adapted populations are running their own operations. Our assignment is to evacuate people who can live in full or lazy Earth gravity. Clément is focused on those who can pay, but anyone who can stand in full... She remembered that the man had cut his explanation off in mid-sentence, rather than let Clément catch him talking out of turn. Great, Petrovic said aloud, and returned to her suite.
All right, everybody, that was 6 of 21 chapters of Last Train to Mordor. I haven't done audio recordings for the entire series yet. This is a time-consuming process, but there are more, and they are available on my Substack. I stopped when I did for a couple of reasons. One, it was about an hour. That's a good length for a podcast. And two, the next chapter contains a rather explicit sex scene, which I wasn't going to throw out to people unannounced on a podcast like this. If you want to hear that scene, go to my Substack. It is kmoptimal.substack.com. Look for Last Train to Mordor. The next chapter, the one you're looking for, is called The Strong. You can find links to my novel on Amazon, on the Substack, or you could just go to Amazon and type in Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt. All right, that is all for this episode. I would love to hear from you. Feel free to post a comment here or over on Substack, and maybe we can start up a discussion. All right, stay well.